Renee Fleming has built her career on singing the most famous and demanding soprano roles. Yet over her 2.5 decades at the top of the opera world, she's developed a reputation as the people's diva. Diva, a distinction that makes her seem at times like more of a diplomat. She's been an advocate for music education in schools. She's also served as a creative consultant at the Lyric Opera in Chicago, not to mention the wide swath of musical geography she's covered by releasing jazz, rock, and American songbook recordings and new works from young composers. Recently, Ms. Fleming has distilled all of those diverse interests into a 4-part concert series at Carnegie Hall's Stern Auditorium called Perspectives, Renee Fleming. The final concert, called Vienna, Window to Modernity, is going to be performed this coming Saturday, and it is with great pleasure that I welcome Renee Fleming back to our show. Hello.
Thank you. Hi.
You've been able to embrace all kinds of opportunities, singing in many different genres. Did you envision a single unifying concept for this event? Or these events?
No. In fact, the opposite was true. In fact, I tried ultimately to go outside of the unifying themes that have been throughout my career, particularly here in New York, thinking about the New York audience in particular. And I tried to kind of find projects that would interest the public, hopefully, but also be unexpected to some degree.
Well, you began the 4-part series with a recital that featured you alongside your friend, mezzo-soprano Susan Graham. What did you perform that evening?
That was all French music, and she's pretty much a specialist in French opera and French song literature, and I've loved it also. It's been one of my favorite languages to sing in. So we had the best time because we not only it was a fun program of really parlor duets that would have been performed probably in people's homes when they were composed, but by great composers, some spectacular music, and we told the stories of the people who inhabited the period in France.
And Zachary Wolf of the New York Times said that the two of you fit together like matching puzzle pieces. Now, how much preparation do you do for something like that? You can't do the sort of thing that jazz musicians would do, where you have one quick run through and then you go out there and just rely on each other?
Well, the hardest thing by far with these kinds of programs is the actual programming, is coming up with the music, deciding on an order, deciding on which pieces that we really want to learn, figuring out which versions, which keys. That is all the most time-consuming element. And then when we rehearsing is fun. That's the fun part. That's really the easy part. We both are comfortable in the language and certainly in the style, and being together is a joy. We started together. We had a wonderful history all along, so that we had a terrific time.
When you say being comfortable in the language, can you speak French?
Yeah, I speak French. I speak fluent German, some Italian, and languages are really important, and to the degree to which we can become comfortable in at least the Romance languages, it can be very helpful for us.
Well, I've always wondered how you or a foreign singer winds up singing English so well, but how you can sing in Russian one day, German the next, Czech the next, Spanish the next, and do it in a way that nobody from those countries would say, boy, is she really messing this up?
It's interesting because it's only one generation removed that we now, not only do we sing in foreign languages, but younger singers are taking it a step further, are learning to read in other alphabets and Cyrillic, and really, really immersing themselves
wow.
in languages that in my generation, it, just me singing in Czech was a revelation. So, and before that, people basically sang in their own native language or maybe Italian and German.
You said that one of your goals in this series was to showcase the way that singing has evolved throughout the years, especially with technological innovation. What do you mean by that? You're not using a microphone, are you?
No. The technology has to do a lot with, the way the internet people are using that to kind of learn about music. Our YouTube is a phenomenal help to us because it's there's so much available now. All of the historic recordings, for the most part, have been downloaded, and it's just a fantastic time to explore music.
Well, at a time when people are saying young the young generation is not all that interested in classical music. So do you think that the internet might at least change that a little bit?
I have a one of my two children has become immersed in 40 song stylists. So who knows what the, you know? She was quizzing me on Nina Simone one day, and I thought, God, this is really impressive. And I said, how did you find this? And she just they surf YouTube if they're interested in music. So yeah, I do think it will open some doors.
Were your parents music teachers?
Yeah, they were both high school vocal music teachers. So. You know, I've jokingly referred to myself all along as an indentured servant.
And it was a classical music from the start?
Yeah,
because,
but everything.
Because Illinois Jacquet was a figure in yes. your early career, wasn't he?
Well, and my dad listened to jazz. And I started singing jazz because of the success of Chuck Mangione in Rochester, New York. Esther Satterfield, who sang with him, was someone who also taught music with my parents, and that sort of sparked my imagination. So I auditioned for the big band, and then that's how I eventually met Illinois.
But you've said that when you were younger, music always felt like the family's thing as opposed to your thing. When did it become your thing?
Yeah, it was the thing we all had to do. You know, if you grew up in a sports family, you all played sports, etc. But it became mine, I think, because I started writing music in middle school, and that was really an expressive outlet for me, one I needed. And it also became mine when I discovered sort of my own brand of popular music. And then, you know, I thought I would go into school for music education because, you know, I really, really wanted to be First Lady President, a job that's still open, sadly. And there was no real encouragement or sort of outlet where I grew up. It was a very small town. And so music just kind of, I kept on that path. It was circumstantial more than anything else.
Are you going to enter the primaries?
Right. No. Well, you know, yes. The primaries for advocating for music, I think, at this point.
Well, I mentioned Illinois Jacquet. Jazz fans know him because he's one of the great tenor players. He heard you sing in a club in Potsdam?
He did. It was a master class, actually. He came up and taught, and he cried. It was the sweetest thing, and asked me shortly after that to come on tour with the big band and him. And I just was too shy and not ready. I went to graduate school instead.
Do you regret that?
No, not at all. No. I definitely ended up where I belong.
And what were you singing at that time?
I was studying classical music, so I was singing a little bit of everything, the same as all students learn.
If you had gone in the other direction, do you think it would have damaged your voice or affected your voice?
I think damaged voices work very well in popular music and jazz. And sometimes, to some degree, it can create the special sound that makes someone unique. It's when it doesn't work, you know, in the case of some of the greatest singers who've had surgeries recently and don't come back. So it depends really on your technique and how you use the voice.
The surgery is because they didn't sing correctly, and
right, it's always
you wind
that.
Up getting nodes
yeah.
on your vocal cords,
but or whatever. I mean, there are all kinds of injuries, but there are some people who have nodes who sound fabulous, and it's what makes their sound distinctive.
Well, Billie Holiday, Nina Simone, you mentioned they didn't have perfect voices, but they had wonderful voices,
voices. It's only in classical music, really, that this requirement for a pure, pristine, healthy sound, even extreme range, and of course the ability to do it without being amplified, our requirements, I think, are the most athletic in a way.
And the same thing happens with people playing instruments. Wynton Marsalis has to change his embouchure when he switches from jazz to classical music.
Right, exactly. It's a whole different. I mean, there are the people who play jazz who have classical background, by and large, sometimes have great chops because they've developed the instrument itself.
But I once read somebody making the claim that every singer of the 20th century, from the 20th century on, was influenced by Louis Armstrong. In some way, in just the way that people approach the lyrics to a song. Do you see that?
I've never heard that, actually.
Or just
no.
the way you singing
Frank
popular
Sinatra,
music.
I could imagine.
Well, he was influenced by Louis. So.
Yeah. So, yeah, no, I hadn't heard that before, actually. But sure, why not? I mean, he was a great, great artist. There's no question.
You're considered a lyrical soprano. And now, if you sing something like La Traviata, yeah, to be three different kinds of sopranos, don't you?
Yeah, Traviata is a very demanding part, and it is in the four acts really split up into three types of singing, types of pathos in a way, and that's the challenge of that role. But she's so grateful. The audience loves her no matter what.
Well, Violetta.
Yes.
But do you like switching from one to the other? Because each act, you're coloratura, then regular, I don't know, you go to dramatic soprano at the end.
Right. I like acting this role. It's rich. There's so much character there. And, you know, at best, when I sing Violetta, when I have sung her, I really felt that I'm acting and speaking. You know, that's the really, when the audience is so involved in the story that they're not so much aware that we're singing, that's ideal.
And some operas lend themselves to that more than others.
Yeah, definitely.
Well, you also played Blanche Dubois. That's a great acting role in the André Previn opera,
definitely,
The Streetcar Named Desire.
We just did that, and it was really wonderful to come back to that role after 15 years. I mean, Blanche is really my Tosca and my Norma, my only time that I get to really chew the scenery.
It was. Did you introduce that role?
I premiered it.
So that's different than all of those other roles where thousands of other singers have done it over the years. Some have become pretty famous singing the same arias that you're going to be singing.
Exactly. Well, and in premiering Anders Hillborg piece this just a few nights ago, it's interesting. When something is written for you, of course, then it can play to your strengths. And with a conductor or a composer who's really sensitive to that, it can be a phenomenal experience, because what we spend most of our time doing is trying to fit into the mold created by someone else.
My guest is Renee Fleming, whose series Perspectives, Renee Fleming, ends. It's the fourth of the series. It will be this coming Saturday. It's Vienna, Window to Modernity. And the concert features Strauss, Brahms, Wagner, Schoenberg, Anton Webern. Not all Austrians, are they?
Yeah, I think they. Webern, I'm not sure about.
And not Alban Berg, who wrote operas.
Sorry?
Not Alban Berg.
He's not on the program. The program is really interesting because I had to, with the Emerson Quartet and Jeremy Denk, it was a challenge. First of all, I never sing chamber music, and I love it, and it's a fabulous opportunity and a luxury for me to get to do that. But Gene said from the beginning, Gene Drucker, actually, it's the concertmaster, or what do you call the first violinist in the quartet? Probably something else. Anyway,
he called him the first violinist.
First violinist, yes. And he said, let's look for music that was specifically composed for quartet. So that was a big challenge in the end. There isn't that much for quartet with singers. But it was a lot of fun exploring and really digging deeper, and in fact even creating a transcription of the Eric Seisel, two of those songs.
Eric Seisel, who wrote Hollywood films. He wrote the music for The Postman Always Rings Twice, but more important, one of the Abbott and Costello movies.
Well, you know, I love his song literature. You know, I talked to his daughter, and who is married to Schoenberg's, into Schoenberg's family as well. And what's fascinating about him is that he became this brilliant songwriter. There are many, many songs. So being able to sort of discover that and bring that to the public is fascinating.
Well, this piece is called, the concert's called Window to Modernity, because in a way, by performing music by these various composers, we see how music developed at that time, at least in the German style.
Well, what's wonderful is that, you know, Vienna was such a hotbed of culture, really worldwide, because you had the art and the architecture that we know and love. We had Freud, and you had this transition between late Romantic and 12-tone composition that really fed the entire 20th century. So it's been exciting to be steeped in this, and I was sort of inspired by, of course, the music of Richard Strauss that I specialize in, really, and then to Erich Korngold from there.
Who also wrote for movies.
Yes, well, really famously, and then to from there to discover all of these other composers was the next step in a way. And so many of them, of course, emigrated to the United States, and some of them found success and many did not. So it's hard to imagine what their lives would have been like had they been able to continue on.
Well, Schoenberg wrote his opera, Moses und Arend, on Aaron when he was in California, in Palos Verdes, I think.
You know, he at least he was so well established when he came here that his reputation has grown and grown. And in fact, you know, I love this image of him playing tennis with Gershwin. There's something wonderful about that.
You've said that 80% of your repertoire was new music 100 years ago. Was it received in the same way? Did people see it as new music and object to it until they became more familiar with it?
Well, most of what was performed was new music, and singers in that time, now it's sort of unusual when people say, oh, how wonderful of you to dedicate some of your time to new works. And I think, why wouldn't you? I mean, why would we want this art form to become a museum collection of historic pieces? It was always a living art form until recently. So singers, by and large, you look back at the famous singers of the day, and it was just one new piece after another. Puccini was new. All of the things that we take for granted as standard rep were completely new then.
I recently spoke to Diana Damrau, a very great singer. She hates the word diva.
Mm-hmm.
You've been called the people's diva. Do you see that as a kind of a contradiction, an oxymoron?
It is an oxymoron, and that's what's so kind of sweet about it. But the diva's been so broadly used in recent years. In fact, I think most people don't even realize what the roots of it were. And there wasn't an opera diva. I think it was invented for Sarah Bernhardt, I think, as it means goddess. So I actually love the word when it's applied to me on stage. Otherwise, it has a negative connotation.
Now, we've seen Plácido Domingo move from tenor roles to baritone roles. Does the same thing happen with someone like you?
No, it could. I mean, it could have.
Obviously, you're not going to go from being a tenor to a baritone.
No, right. No. There are some sopranos who've really changed their repertoire into much heavier, much lower repertoire. But my voice, you really have to take your cue from your instrument, and my voice has not changed.
The first in the series that we've been discussing, Perspectives, Renee Fleming, the one with Susan Graham, will actually be broadcast on it was originally done in January. It will be broadcast on WQXR on Friday, May 4th at 8 p.m. It will be rebroadcast then. I guess this concert will be broadcast sometime in the future?
I don't know, actually.
Well,
I think
just
maybe.
Hope.
I think it's just Susan, I think, and I.
Meanwhile, for ticket information, you can go to our show page at WNYC.org. We'll be going out of this with Renee Fleming singing Morgan, the last song in Strauss's last song cycle. Will you be performing this?
It's an encore, actually. It's a planned encore. So,
Renee Fleming, Perspectives, Renee Fleming, Vienna, Window to Modernity, the final concert in her Carnegie Hall residency this coming Saturday at 8 p.m. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you so much.